All right, ladies and gentlemen, around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Lawyer to Lawyer Network and the Saltz Mongoluzzi Bendeschi Hour. We've got a fantastic show. We're going to be talking mass torts. We're going to be talking toxic torts. We're going to be talking about the whole kit and caboodle. I couldn't be happier than to have Larry Cohan, who's a partner here at Saltz Mongoluzzi Bendeschi, and of course, Joshua Cohan, who's an associate here at Saltz Mongoluzzi and Bendeschi. First, Larry, how are you?
I am doing well today. Thank you, Joe.
It's my pleasure. Certainly fantastic to have you on the broadcast. You head the mass tort and toxic tort division, correct?
I do.
And if you would, introduce yourself a little bit to our listeners and tell us a little bit about what the mass tort and toxic tort division is and does. What are they?
Absolutely. I'm a partner here at Saltz Mongoluzzi and Bendeschi. I've been practicing law as a trial lawyer for over 40 years. I've tried a lot of jury trials, handled a lot of cases both locally and nationally in this specialty, which I'm going to tell you and our listeners about. Toxic torts, mass torts. Often get confused with class actions. That is something different. We can touch on that a little bit later. These are cases that typically involve individuals that have unique exposures, and they become massive. So they end up getting consolidated into one court. A toxic tort is a tort, an injury to a person, caused by a chemical exposure. Very unique. So the very first original mass tort, toxic tort, was asbestos exposure.
Okay.
Mesothelioma cases. That began in the late 1970s.
Yeah.
Created a model for what ultimately became a very busy part of the practice of law, mass torts. And our specialty involves mass torts and toxic torts. And go ahead.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because we talked earlier before the broadcast, obviously mesothelioma, which I could not say when we first started the broadcast, but when we first started talking about it, as part of our labor show, Pat Iding, who's the president of the AFL-CIO, but used to be the head of the Insulators Union, certainly we've done shows on that and the absolute tragic situations that he's gone through with his members. There's not a member of his apprentice class still alive. Yep. So getting through those shows were, Pat's a very emotional guy. So, very familiar with that. And when you say toxic torts, it comes to mind Aaron Brockovich, that move, is that kind of the area?
Yeah, I like to tell my friends that I was Aaron Brockovich before she was. we handled those cases over 40 years ago before she had her case and her movie came out.
Yeah.
Asbestos was the original one, but this evolved over the years. Benzene used at refineries and in other locations causes leukemia. That's another big one. Talc, we now are looking at.
It talc causes powder cases, right?
Ovarian cancer. Paraquat, used on farms and by landscapers. It's an herbicide. It causes Parkinson's disease.
Yeah.
And there's many more. And that's led us into related fields. Water contamination, PFAS, which we're reading about now, and it's a big problem across the country. It's led us into dealing with vaccines.
Yeah.
And we work in the federal claims court where there is a vaccine court. So this unique practice includes all of these areas, many not as well known as mesothelioma. And unfortunately, I've worked with a lot of victims there. And the victims in these other exposure cases suffer equally as badly in many respects. And we're here to talk about all of that today.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. Saltz Mongoluzzi and Bendeschi is a fantastically successful firm who's done a great job on behalf of my community, which is the union labor community. It's important when somebody goes through any type of situation like that. They may only meet a lawyer once in their life, but it's so important to work with the right lawyer. Let me segue over to Joshua Cohan.
Yes,
I love we talked about it before. So I'm sensing that this is a family affair.
That's correct.
It is.
Yeah, but what I love about that is there's a big firm, a very successful large firm, but a family atmosphere within it, and that personal touch is incredibly important. If you would, Josh, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you kind of navigated to where we're at today.
Sure. First off, I really appreciate you having us here today, so thank you.
It's our pleasure.
And it is it's my pleasure to be able to get to work with Larry, who is my boss and my dad, and we're very fortunate that we get to be in this position at a great firm like Saltz Mongoluzzi and Bendesky. I had a bit of a unique entry into the mass tort field. A lot of times you go and you practice plaintiff's work, plaintiff's litigation, and you get into mass torts a little bit later. But I was fortunate to get in right out of law school, and I started up working on some mass tort cases, including the NFL concussion litigation.
Yep.
Really for the last 9 years or so since I've been in practice, my practice has focused on mass tort cases, pharmaceutical mass tort, other product liability mass tort, including medical devices. And then over the last few years, as I've begun to work with Larry, I've gotten more into toxic tort litigation as well.
And it's interesting because you have you're fighting the it's always the Goliath, but what it's the insurance company, and you're representing people who cannot obviously can't fight for themselves, the regular people out there. However, what's fantastic about the firm is that it's not exactly David versus Goliath when Saltz Mongoluzzi and Bendesky's on the case. You have the resources to be able to represent your clients and fight against the biggest insurance companies, and Saltz Mongoluzzi Bendesky handles these cases. These cases are somewhat complex in regards to representing a whole group of people but it's all under one. You're gonna have to explain it because I've had that conversation. But how important is that to have the resources to be able to fight those entities? Because we're talking about, and I'm just throwing out there, but when you talk about talcum powder and all that, Johnson & Johnson, corporations that are so big that they don't even put a disclaimer on the bottle. And they got 1,000 claims filed against them.
Doesn't get a lot bigger than Johnson & Johnson. That's right.
That's right. But when you do this, and not everybody can do it, you have the resources to be able to fight and win.
You're absolutely right. It's a good point. Fortunately, this firm has given us a platform to handle these cases, the resources to handle these cases. A regular solo practitioner, small firm lawyer would never have the capability, the people power, the dollars, the know-how to take on these big companies in these big complex cases. And every one we take on brings new and really exciting issues for us to address so that we can break new ground. And we often are. And I mentioned the water litigation when I commented a few minutes ago. Right here in Montgomery and Bucks County, there are 100,000 homes that have lost their water to this AFFF firefighting foam product that contains PFAS. And everybody, if they haven't heard about it, they will. There's a movie out about it that came out recently. Josh, what was the name of the movie?
Dark Waters. It involved the chemical PFAS that's found in firefighting foam. And as Larry mentioned, the use of this firefighting foam at two military bases up in Bucks and Montgomery County contributed to the contamination in the area. And this movie, Dark Waters, that came out within the last year or two, it focuses on PFAS contamination in a different community.
And the fact is, there's no coincidence that when it's typically a name case that it ends up on your doorsteps.
Exactly.
A lot of that, I'm sure, has to do with individuals, but also a lot of other firms. You look at the duck boat cases, right? That was in, was it Louisiana? In other words, one in Philly, but I mean, the most recent one was like in Louisiana or something like that.
Another jurisdiction.
Right.
And they brought us in.
Well, yep. And the lawyers out there brought Saltz Mongoluzzi Bendesky in.
Yep.
How
we were brought in, Joe, by the water providers up there in the counties, just north and west of Philly, because they wanted Philadelphia lawyers that could handle this kind of complex chemical exposure, toxic tort litigation. And it's now become a huge national problem, and we're part of an MDL, which is a multi-district litigation, meaning all the cases from around the country involving this contaminant have been consolidated in front of one judge down in Charleston, South Carolina. Josh and I have to go to the hearings there, meet with the judge, and fight with the lawyers from all over the country representing the chemical producers, all of which, like you said, are big Fortune 500 companies.
And now, Joe, to your point before, we do practice nationally, and we get called into cases in other states, and we probably represent clients in all 50 states. So our practice is a national one.
Yeah, and I can say this, you know, the firm, and I mean, there's everybody's working all day, and you know, you guys, this is hopping. I mean, you know, even during the pandemic, sure. I know you guys are busy.
It never slows down.
That's right. And having said that, it's a busy firm, and you get into the tort, the mass tort area. If you explain, you know, even to me, because I've had this conversation before, but how. What a mass tort is in comparison to a class action.
Sure, yeah. Let me give you an example of a class action and then an example of a mass tort, and that'll help to illustrate the picture. So when you think of a class action, that's a lawsuit filed by one individual on behalf of a group of other individuals that have been harmed in the same way. So let's take an example of a defective washing machine that leaks. One person who owns that washing machine might file a class action lawsuit on behalf of 50,000 washing machine owners across the country. And at the end of the day, if there's a resolution, everybody that's part of that class action, that one lawsuit, would be entitled to a new washing machine, or they would get compensated such that with enough money that they could go buy a new washing machine. A mass tort, unlike a class action where one person sues on behalf of a group of individuals, a mass tort involves a large number of individual lawsuits that are all consolidated, and that there's coordination among the lawyers that are working on the cases, and there's coordination among the courts as well. So an example of a mass tort might be, let's go back to talcum powder, which you mentioned before. Talcum powder has been linked to ovarian cancer. And women across the country have filed their individual lawsuits for claiming that they've gotten ovarian cancer as a result of talcum powder use. All of those individual lawsuits, or the vast majority of them, have been consolidated in one court in front of one judge. And there's a group effort to move these cases forward, coordination among all the parties. And then there's a saving of judicial resources by having all these cases in front of one judge. So at the end of the day, a class action is one lawsuit on behalf of a group of individuals. And you see class action more in the economic context when there's been economic damages, but not personal injuries like developing cancers and disease. And then a mass tort involves lots of individual lawsuits where there's a lot of coordination. And mass tort cases usually involve injury where somebody's developed a cancer or other specific diseases that have been linked to exposure to a certain product.
Now, as a layman, I've heard that on a mass tort level, there's more potential for recovery per individual claimant.
Exactly.
And plaintiff.
Exactly. And that goes back to the fact that mass torts involve individual lawsuits. And one of the reasons for that is because mass torts involve cases where people are injured, and everybody's injuries are different. If somebody has a heart attack or a stroke, it affects everybody differently. It impacts everybody differently. And a class action doesn't really allow for the individualization of awards at the end of the day. Whereas in a mass tort, if there's a successful mass tort, and if there's there's a settlement at the end of the day and those people involved are getting compensated, those individuals who have individual lawsuits will be entitled to compensation that's commensurate with their individual injury.
And that's what I was going to say.
Exactly.
How do the settlements get kind of like laid out in regards to somebody's individual case? Would somebody... Yeah,
in the washer-dryer situation, you know, you get $100 to buy a new washer or dryer.
Right.
And that's a class action. Everybody gets the same thing for the most part.
In a mass tort situation, your case is going to be evaluated individually. We can take them to trial. One person that's part of a big mass tort filing can get their own jury trial. At the end of the day, if there's a global settlement, like there was in Roundup,
right,
just very recently, Every person's individual case then gets evaluated within the context of a large settlement, and somebody who's younger, more seriously ill, more heavily exposed is going to get paid more than somebody who is not.
So there's a decision, a mass decision, and then after that, you determine the damage of the individual, the different settlement amounts.
So, for example, in Roundup, we read in the news that there was an $8 to $10 billion lawsuit settlement.
Right.
Well, okay, who gets that? Well, the many thousands of people who filed individual claims then stake their claim. And it's kind of a process of analyzing each case and then using that $10 billion to fairly compensate everybody who has a case.
Now, who testifies in the main case? In other words, you mentioned lawyers coordinate. How about, cooperate. Mm-hmm. How does that work? Obviously, you guys here at the firm are extremely successful. Okay, and I can't imagine what it's like when you have some individual who's, a cowboy out there, and he thinks that he should be, but he might be one guy at a boutique firm. Who knows? Not that he can't be a good attorney, but the point is, who litigates the actual case and who are the actual witnesses for the main case? How does that decide it?
Good question. And Josh used the word a few minutes ago, coordination. Try to imagine one woman out in Idaho, or nothing against Idaho, North Dakota, that has talc exposure and ovarian cancer. And her doctor says, I think that talc caused it. She is going to hire a local lawyer and fight Johnson & Johnson for the next 8 years.
Right.
It'll cost her millions of dollars. She could not prosecute that claim.
Sure.
She files her case. Somebody else files theirs. All across the country, people file their claims. We consolidate them into a mass tort. Now we have a coordinating judge. And everybody has to work together by law. The judge makes sure that we do. So all of the depositions of the corporate defendants, the sellers of the product that was defective, they get deposed one time. The plaintiff's bar has a team that we put together to be as effective as possible. We bring all of the resources of plaintiff's lawyers like us from across the country together to fight that one claim. Now, when you get down to the individual person's claim later in the process, which we touched on a few minutes ago, each individual plaintiff has an opportunity to have their own medical records presented, their own doctor testify, and then they get to give a plaintiff's deposition for themselves.
And who are they giving that for? The same judge?
Same judge, wow. Corporate judge. Now, there is something called remand, and that's a process whereby the mass tort court, the MDL court, the consolidated court, can send a case back to that person's home state, to their own trial judge, and say, go ahead and try this one. And that happens. They can be tried in the central court, or they can be sent back. There's a lot of reasons to do it both ways.
Yep, and in mass torts, I want to be clear. When there is a trial, at the end of the day, many mass torts, individual cases do end up going to trial. And when there is a trial, that is a trial for one individual plaintiff. That's not a trial for everybody in the mass tort. However, whether there's a plaintiff's verdict, whether the plaintiff loses, that will help inform all of the attorneys and all the parties in the litigation.
Well, can one small case affect?
Absolutely. So even though maybe one small case, again, whether it's a win or loss, that's only going to, that case really only pertains to the one individual, but it will impact everybody in the mass tort because both the parties, the plaintiff's attorneys, defense attorneys, they're going to see that case went really well. They're going to see that case went really bad. And maybe there are ongoing settlement discussions, and a case that goes bad for the plaintiffs going to result in there being a dramatic shift in those discussions. So these individual trials, which are called bellwether trials, because they serve as a bellwether for the entire litigation, they are only for one person, but absolutely they can have a huge impact on the entire litigation.
Now let's take a general list. So if listeners are out there and listen to what we're saying, We're going to talk about some specific cases that you're handling, but I would like to just sort of do a little bit of layout of the cases that you're handling. And I say that because we may not break down all of them, obviously. I just would like to kind of give people who may not know some idea of the types of cases that you're handling, and then we'll do the four major breakdowns, or the three major breakdowns that we're talking about.
Okay. Yeah, we could talk about these cases all day.
Well, I mean, just like list it, like you're handling M3. You're handling the M3 earphone.
So the 3M earplug 3M. Litigation, defective earplugs that caused deafness and tinnitus in military folks. Paraquat, which I mentioned, which is an herbicide that causes Parkinson's disease. Talc causes, obviously, ovarian cancer. We're dealing with a very unique litigation called the fibrocell tainted bone litigation.
Wow.
It's a human tissue product used for surgical implantation in spinal surgeries and others. Unfortunately, a large batch of it was sold across the country last year, tainted with tuberculosis. A small mass tort in terms of numbers, but significant. The firefighting foam litigation involves people who drink water in neighborhoods that are contaminated and firefighters who are exposed. Causes all kinds of cancers. Asbestos, which we've already mentioned, and benzene. One of the most unique ones that we're involved in is vaccines, which kind of runs its own track. Maybe we should, if we have time, talk about that for a few minutes.
Sure.
It's current, it's relevant, and it's very unique, and very few people out there, lawyers, doctors, or anybody, really understand the law associated with vaccine claims.
Yeah, no question about it. I find it amazing. Is there a website if somebody's just looking to see, they may have one of these situations, is there information where they can find to see if they may be, should look into this? And
absolutely. So a few different ways that anybody who's interested can go about it. Our main website, which is smbb.com, and that's S as in Sam. On that website, that will list out all the different types of litigations we're involved in, including all the various mass torts we're currently handling. In terms of vaccine claims, there's a website called vaccineinjurylaw.com that contains all sorts of information about these vaccine cases. And then lastly, I'd encourage any listener, if they've developed a cancer, a disease after being exposed to a product, or if they've seen something on TV or in advertisements, give us a call. It's something that we may be looking at, that we may be handling, and we're always happy to talk to anybody.
You know, it dawns on me that although you're outstanding attorneys, you must know the medicine and the medical part of this incredibly well. How important is that in what you guys do? Because these are somewhat complex.
Yep. In law school, we learn law.
Right.
We don't learn science or medicine.
I joke that Larry could be a doctor if he wanted to, with the amount of science and medicine that he's learned through
this
practice.
I'm sure.
I should be a physician's assistant.
One day I could be a doctor.
A couple years more, he'll be a doctor.
Away.
I can only imagine family members calling. He's going, listen, I got a sore throat. He's probably. We know the answer.
But it gets calls happened. Both of us all the time.
having that knowledge and that obviously experience is vitally important. Talk about the contingency fee agreement. I say that because obviously attorneys of the caliber of yourselves and the firm, it'd be very difficult for anybody. If there was a retainer that they had to, come out of pocket, talk about the contingency fee agreement and how when people call you and you're, vetting something, or even if you're going to represent their case, there's no out of pocket costs, and you don't get paid if you don't win.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's true generally of plaintiffs that are injured that they could never, most people, afford to pay a lawyer to handle the case.
Sure.
Nowhere is it more true than when we get into these cases. As you just said, with complex medicine and science, we don't get out of a case without 5 or 10 experts. years of research and work and study. So yes, everything we do is contingency fee percentage. We cover the costs. Fortunately, our firm supports that effort, and it is a major investment to handle one of these complex mass tort or toxic tort cases from beginning to end.
And that's kind
it's
of
a long ride.
Yeah, that's
lots
right.
Lots of years.
And when somebody calls and they, you know, I'm sure there's a vetting process. What I want to get across to the listener is, you know, obviously this can be an expensive vetting process.
Sure, but it may be expensive to us, but that expense does not get passed on to to the client.
But having said that, you have a, you know, sometimes you're so when you take somebody on as a client, you're in a sense investing in their case without them having to risk what's going on, because on a mass tort case. Talk up, and that's why I said it. You know, 99.9% of the time, no matter how good the firm is, it's David versus Goliath. In other words, that firm and the client are tiny compared to the insurance company. And but your firm has the resources to be able to invest in the case. You don't have to chance on experts. There's no expense. Doesn't mean that you're not looking at everything and obviously making sure. But talk about the potentially, even when you're vetting a case, how much it might cost, especially a mass tort or toxic tort case, to invest in actually determining whether it's an actual case.
It's a good question. And sometimes people don't appreciate it when they say, oh, the lawyer's taking a third of the recovery.
Listen, before you go another, I'll tell you this, Larry. Every time I hear about the contingency fee agreement, I get goosebumps, and I think to myself, it's a godsend for somebody, a regular person out there, to be able to get individuals to work at that level, and they don't have to come out of pocket, and it might last two, three, four years.
Yeah. On these mass torts, they can last 7, 8, 9 years. That's not the norm, but they can go on for a decade.
Because exactly,
they're so complex, often take 5 to 10 years. And you're right, just to investigate a case is tens of thousands of dollars, often. To get deep into a case,
once you've already taken it, you haven't even taken it, you might be spending tens of thousands of dollars.
That's right. Hundreds of thousands. If you're involved in a major mass tort and you stay in it for years, not just the costs of expert witnesses and depositions, but remember, we have multiple lawyers and paralegals on every file on a mass tort litigation. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars can end up being in the millions that we spend to get to the end of a big, complex litigation.
That's incredible. And I want to, my partner, Joe Krause, who's my broadcasting partner, he always says that radio is theater of the mind. And so I want to paint a little picture of where we're sitting right now. And I said this to Larry Bendesky on our last broadcast. The White House was created to put an aura of, you know, obviously an unfair advantage to foreign heads of state. Come on up, the Saltz, Mongolusian, Bendesky, and sit at the top floors of Liberty One. And I don't care who you are, okay, where you're working, what firm, what defense firm you're talking about. It's an awesome experience just to be here to do to do the broadcast, for crying out. I can't imagine. That
we feel that way every day.
Yeah, it's an awesome experience, and having that the ability to compete at that level and have those resources is an awesome responsibility. Talk about setting expectations for your clients, because as great as Saltz, Mongolusian, Bendesky is, the insurance companies don't just roll over and say, okay, here comes Larry. They might when Josh walks in, but my point is, they don't just roll over.
Sure.
What do they say?
Little do they know, they got more to worry about from him than me.
Yeah. You taught him everything he knows. So.
And he's got more going on.
Exactly. Yep. But I mean, literally speaking, setting that table at the beginning for somebody, because you know you're trying to set a table for a client who, you know, in the best circumstance possible. Because insurance companies, what do they say? They're in business to take, you know, to take in money, not to pay it out. Could take some time. Talk about that conversation.
Yeah, setting expectations. It's a challenge in any case, and especially in the mass tort world where these cases are extremely complex. Whereas we were just saying that they can go on for years and years and years. And look, we don't get into mass torts that we don't believe are viable cases. We won't get into a case unless we see the medical, the scientific support, whether we believe that we need to believe that we can be successful in that case. But there are no guarantees in litigation, and we're very upfront and very honest with our clients. We don't like to make promises that we can't keep. And the reality is that there are no guarantees in life. There's no guarantees in litigation, and that includes the mass tort world. But what we tell our clients, and it's the truth, we get into cases because we believe in them, and we're going to do everything we can to get them a recovery at the end of the day. Now, does it mean we're going to be successful 100% of the time? No, we can't know going into a case where there may not be a resolution for 8 years. What the end of the day is going to bring, but we let our clients know that we're going to do everything we can to get a great recovery on their behalf.
And that's the one thing you can guarantee, that they're going to get the best representation possible.
We're going to do everything we can to try to get that for them.
And I can imagine the conversation. You don't have to imagine it, but I do. You know, somebody comes in that they're going through a lot. We're talking these mesh cases and the talcum powder cases, which also they kind of roll into the asbestos in some cases, right? Because you're dealing with people who are in very difficult situations, and we're going to kind of break down a few of those types of cases when we come back after the break. But I say that because you know, these cases take a normal course, no matter how good you are, and you have to let these people know, as bad as their situation is that this may not, you know, we may not get, this may take a couple years under the best situations. I say setting expectations, because if you walk in with those expectations and the insurance company is going to roll over, you could be your own worst enemy as a client.
Absolutely.
I know you guys are, you know, very personable, and it's a family environment, and very personable in a large firm. But somebody, you know, I'm assuming you've had clients, you know, that have called you 3 weeks in a row and say, you know, about 2 months in, going, where are we at? And that setting expectations has to be a big part of you know, setting them up for success so they don't deflate themselves.
Absolutely. And the expectation setting in this world that we're working in is much different than most litigation. Somebody in an auto accident, yeah, there's going to be a settlement a year, 2 years down the road. There's a parameter for how big it might be. We don't have that. And we make it clear on day one. And we really make a point of sharing what we're dealing with our clients. So even when we're working on a giant mass tort, we represent hundreds of people. We do regular, now that we're in the COVID era, Zoom meetings with our clients. We send them regular letters letting them know what's going on in the courthouse with the judge and the litigation. We try to give them links to what they can learn about the litigation. So the expectation also includes them understanding how this litigation is going. Almost all of them are national issues. You can pick up the paper and read about a lot of the things we're working on.
Certainly find them online.
Absolutely. Every one of these, they're fascinating to read about. And obviously, we love talking to our clients.
And talking about expectations, one thing I'll note, the listeners may see in the news these massive verdicts in mass tort cases. And there will be, it's likely if there was a $1 billion verdict, it very well may have been part of a mass tort case. And those types of successes are incredible. And they're incredible for the plaintiffs, the injured victims who've gotten those large recoveries. But as I said before, these trials and these big verdicts in the mass tort world are only for one individual case and one individual plaintiff. So we do have new clients who call up and say, oh, I saw somebody got a $4 billion verdict. When do I get my billion? And that does happen. But in terms of setting expectations, unfortunately, most people in a mass tort are not going to get that $1 billion verdict. I wish that we could get $1 billion
But you educate them all the way through the process.
But we let them know so that they can be informed throughout the process.
Well, let me just lay something out at you, okay? I tripped in the hallway right there. The guy who spilled the McDonald's coffee on him got like $5 million. I want at least that, okay? And I like it soon. Is it possible? How many times have you heard about the McDonald's coffee? Or, you know, I mean,
hundreds.
I know, and certainly that really was a pain in the butt for a lot of plaintiff attorneys. And I heard there was an appeal there, whatever. But my point is, there's always mitigating circumstances that are unforeseen. Before we go to break, I want to talk a little bit about the culture here at the firm. Larry, I got the opportunity to first talk to you about a week ago, okay? And I had the pleasure of talking to Josh earlier that day. I knew within 5 minutes on the phone that I was talking to Serious Cats, okay? And I say that because you're very detailed, you're passionate about what you do, and I having that type of culture in a firm, okay, has to start, you know, obviously with the partners of the firm, but it's got to start right from the beginning, and who you bring in, as associate attorneys, and Josh, just because I have some background on the firm, it's great to have obviously a relationship, but that says a lot about you because, they're not, obviously the culture of the firm is important. You're hitting it and getting it. Where does that come from, and how do you maintain that through this many years? Because this is a serious place.
Absolutely, it's a good point. And the answer, while there are many layers to it, it's really quite simple. It comes from the top. Bob Mongaluzzi, Larry Bendesky, who were not only my partners and colleagues but good friends, are fantastic lawyers, great leaders, great people. They set the example. They set the tone of excellence, the willingness to do whatever we need to do legally, ethically, properly, to spend the money, spend the time to prevail in the case. And we do that, obviously, we all watch them. And that trickles down. Every other partner models themselves after that. So, and then the associates we have at this firm, and I see who we've brought on board. We're bringing people on board that follow that approach. We don't want people that don't want to try cases.
Yeah.
We don't want people that don't want to dig in, roll up their sleeves, and make their cases the best they can be. So it is pervasive here. It is the culture, and there's tremendous synergy. Josh will tell you that the associates here communicate every day. They share information. Well, they share knowledge.
What's contagious is the passion and the intensity level. I mean, literally speaking, I was up on the wrong floor when I came up here, and the guy's like, I'm in the middle of, he was moving while he was talking. You know what I mean? I'm in the middle of a deposition. It was very nice, but, telling me, I had to go, it was the other floor. I say that. Did anybody here see the Beatles, the documentary?
Special? Yeah. I haven't had a chance yet.
Fantastic.
Okay. Well, what I really do really well is I produce music and play the bass guitar. And I was watching, showed them the Beatles in an environment where they were writing songs. And what I broke down, so Paul McCartney was a lawyer, he'd be working here. Okay, because that drive that he had was, unbelievable. And when you looked at it, Ringo Starr was willing to do anything. Like he wouldn't say a word. But the other two, John Lennon, he had made a personal commitment. He no longer could make that band commitment. And then George Harrison was ready to go out on his own. The reason I say that is this: at the highest level in that particular environment, they couldn't stay together because they went in different directions. What impresses me here is that passion and that drive across the board. I don't you can just sense it when you come through. You don't see anybody, you know, like, you know, whining. At least I, you know, like, I mean, it seems like everybody's ready to go, hitting the ground running, and passionate about working.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we're all on the same page here, and I can speak to my fellow associates here. We've got just a great group of people, great group of individuals as people, great group of lawyers. It's a pleasure to get to work with them every day.
Well, it's not a surprise at where the success comes from. We're going to take a brief break, and we're going to have more from the Saltz Mongoluzzi and Bendeski Hour after the break.
Home is meant to be our safe place, but heart attacks and strokes don't stay home. Don't avoid the ER out of anxiety. Don't die of doubt. Don't stay silent, and don't stay home. If you have an emergency, call 911. When seconds count, the hospital is the safest place to be.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Saltz Mongoluzzi and Bendeski Hour. We've got a fantastic broadcast. Our guest are two individuals that not only are family, but they also represent individuals that have been in very serious situations and do so incredibly well. Larry Cohan and Joshua Cohan here in the Mass Tort and Toxic Tort Division of Saltz Mongoluzzi and Bendeski. What I'd like to do now, gentlemen, is break down three areas of mass torts that are cases you're handling as we speak. And one of those would be the talcum powder / ovarian cancer mass tort, which is as devastating as you can get in regards to the damage it's created. Number one, who is eligible to be a part of that mass tort, and what exposure have they had to have, and of course, you know, what physical issues would they be having?
Sure. So the talcum powder litigation is one we are very involved in. It's been ongoing for a number of years now. And the plaintiffs in this litigation are women who have used talcum powder for at least 2 years, and who regularly used it on a daily, weekly basis, and who have subsequently developed ovarian cancer or fallopian tube cancer. This litigation, we talked about mass torts earlier. Again, this is a mass tort. This litigation is centralized in New Jersey in front of one judge. And there are, I believe, in excess of 30,000 claims that are currently filed against Johnson & Johnson. Again, they're all filed by women who use talcum powder regularly and have developed ovarian cancer or fallopian tube cancer. And you mentioned it's devastating. These women, we have a lot of clients we represent that what they've had to go through, what they've had to experience.
Talk about the seriousness of some of the issues. I mean, ovarian cancer is devastating as it is, but some of these individuals may not make it to the end of the case.
That's exactly right. And fortunately, ovarian cancer is curable, and we have plenty of clients who are able to get treatment and who are doing well today and who haven't had recurrences. And that's great. We always prefer a healthy client. But unfortunately, we have clients who have passed away during the pendency of this litigation from their ovarian cancer. So this is a very serious litigation. We're talking about a very serious injury here, and unfortunately, there are a lot of people out there. There's a lot of women out there who are suffering from ovarian cancer after having used talcum powder. Johnson & Johnson's talcum powder, it goes by baby powder. When we say talcum powder, we're referring to Johnson & Johnson's baby powder. We're referring to another product called Shower to Shower, which is also sold by Johnson & Johnson. And these powders contain talc, and that's one ingredient in these powders. And talc has been found to have asbestos in it.
Asbestos, right.
And that's what's ultimately, it's the asbestos in the talc that's ultimately getting in and causing these injuries and causing the ovarian cancer and fallopian tube cancer. And there are so many women. I mentioned the 30,000 to 35,000 plaintiff number. Those are the number of filed lawsuits that are out there. But there are tens of thousands of more women out there that are suffering from ovarian cancer as a result of talcum powder use and who have not filed suit yet.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I also, you should know, and everybody should know, that talcum powder can cause mesothelioma. Obviously, ovarian cancer is caused by women are using it on their bodies, but if you inhale the talcum powder, those fibers can get into your lungs,
right?
And people get mesothelioma from that as well. So it's a multifaceted litigation. I think one of the points that everybody may want to hear about, if they haven't read about it, is Johnson & Johnson's recent effort to avoid exposure to liabilities. What they've done, fascinating, it's called the Texas Two-Step. That's named essentially after the law in Texas. They are obviously a massive billion-dollar international company. They took their talc product, spun it off just last year into its own division. And literally, how many days later?
3 days, I believe.
3 days later, they went into the bankruptcy court, and the talc division declared bankruptcy out of one of the most profitable companies on the planet. And what they argued was that talc, since we can't really sell it anymore because it's deadly and we have a lot of liabilities, it's not profitable, we're going to declare bankruptcy. And this is a brand new fight. They've gotten a stay on all of the litigation across the country, and they're trying to argue to the bankruptcy court that they should have the protection of the court and ultimately pay 10 or 20 cents on the dollar of what their liabilities would have been. Now, this is where a mass tort works to the benefit of the individual victims, because our leadership in the litigation is mounting a fight against J&J, and it is a formidable fight. The briefs are over 100 pages long. The document work and the depositions that have been going on over the past several weeks are an incredible feat of lawyering. And we don't intend to let Johnson & Johnson get away with what is, in essence, not a real bankruptcy.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not an attorney, and I'm not a bankruptcy attorney, but I will say, isn't it kind of, obvious, it's an obvious situation. Do you think the court's actually going to let them get away with it?
Most observers would agree with you on that, and ultimately, will the court let them get away with it? We don't think that the court will, but that remains to be seen.
Sure. And you said that if they do get away with it, they're trying to pay,
if 10, 20 cents on the dollar, like we usually say in bankruptcy claims.
And the problem is, if they get away with it, there will be a new blueprint for every single company out there that sells a dangerous product.
Sure.
That once they start getting sued, they'll spin that product off, create a new division, and then declare bankruptcy. And it would just take away the rights of so many victims out there and future victims who are harmed by dangerous products.
When will the decision be made?
Well, there was a hearing just very recently. There's going to be another hearing because we've been briefing the issue. Fortunately, the bankruptcy, which was originally in North Carolina, where it was filed, that judge moved it to New Jersey, where it belongs, where the MDL is, where the litigation is, where Johnson & Johnson is. So we have a judge who is giving this daily attention. So we're hoping in a matter of weeks the issue is resolved.
What's amazing, you're dealing with a corporation, one of the biggest corporations in the world, and I said it before, you would imagine that if you were a mom and pop and you got those, 10 lawsuits, you would immediately pull that product and or put a disclaimer on it to do something. I don't know if they ever put a disclaimer on it yet, but this has been going on for years. And I know for most of the time they just kept selling it, and they didn't put a disclaimer or educate people on it. That's how big and ignorant they are. And I will say this: if there's a hell, somebody, one of them is going to be in it, because guess what? That type of strategy to be able to provide a product out there that individuals are dying and contracting cancer and not doing anything about it. It is what it is.
You're
devastating.
Right. And just so you know, we knew that there was asbestos in talc, and lawsuits began to get filed back in the 80s and 90s. They did finally, essentially, in America, withdraw it in 2020. after all those years.
Oh, okay.
There were no disclaimers prior to that, and they still haven't admitted the dangers of the product.
Yeah.
But they withdrew it from the market.
I guess it was cheaper to keep it on there and handle the lawsuits compared to the profits they were making.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. So, obviously, talcum powder, J&J, you know, it's, by the way, what kind of proof does somebody have to have? You know, like you mentioned 2 years using it.
Yep.
When they come in and, you know, if that was a situation, is there any way to prove it?
Yeah, that's a challenge we face in some of these cases. And ultimately, we'd love to have receipts of everybody's purchases. We'd love to have leftover bottles of talcum powder. But in most cases, we don't have that.
Of course not.
And at the end of the day, we're going to have to rely on sworn testimony of the plaintiffs attesting under oath that they used the product. And ultimately, if we don't have hard evidence in the form of leftover bottles or receipts, that does not prevent us from moving forward with the talcum powder lawsuit.
Yeah, and the bottom line is this. A regular person's not looking to scam anybody. They want justice. They're sitting on that. In order for them to be a part of the suit, they have had to contract ovarian cancer. Okay?
That's right. And in terms of the ovarian cancer, the other proof that we need is proof of a diagnosis, and fortunately, we're able to get that through medical records. So that's not an issue in most of these cases.
Absolutely. Let's segue on to the firefighting foam, the AFFF cancer-causing, you know, product there.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating litigation that we've touched on so far, and part of what makes it so fascinating are the different types of cases involved in this AFFF or aqueous film-forming foam litigation. There are cases filed on behalf of water providers whose water systems have been contaminated through the use of firefighting foam, and as we mentioned earlier, there's a group of chemicals called PFAS in this firefighting foam, and this firefighting foam, after it's used, is absorbed into the soil, it's washed down the drain, and this dangerous chemical in the foam makes its way into the water systems of municipalities across the country. So there are lawsuits on behalf of water suppliers, water providers, whose water systems have been completely decimated by this chemical, forcing them to shut down their water systems and spend millions of dollars to remediate. There are lawsuits on behalf of individuals who drank that contaminated water unknowingly and developed kidney cancer, developed ulcerative colitis, other diseases.
What about firemen using it?
Exactly. And then that's the last group of the last big group of cases are on behalf of firefighters. And firefighters were the ones that were actually using this firefighting foam every day.
It's not bad enough that you're going into a burning building. That what you're using is toxic and could kill you.
Exactly. Firefighters, putting the foam aside, firefighters are already exposed to so many contaminants and pollutants and breathing in so many different things just through the nature of their job. And now we have a product that's supposed to help them with their job, supposed to make things safer for them and others, and in turn, lo and behold, it's actually causing a lot of damage as well. So yes, the third big group of cases is on behalf of firefighters, and we represent a number of firefighters. And what we're looking for in these cases are firefighters who used AFFF, and I want to be clear that there are a lot of different types of firefighting foams that are sold and that are used out there. AFFF is a certain type of firefighting foam. It's used to fight Class B fires, so really high heat fires, jet fuel fires. It's used at petroleum refineries. It's used at military bases. So there is widespread use, but this litigation does concern a specific type of firefighting foam. And the firefighters we work with, they all know what types of foam they were working with, and they know whether they were using AFFF or not. So the firefighting foam cases, we're looking for firefighters who have used AFFF more than a handful of times. We get calls from firefighters who may have trained with it once. That's not going to be enough. There's not going to be enough exposure there.
And what kind of cancer have they developed?
Yeah, so the cancers we're focusing on right now where there's the strongest support in the scientific literature are testicular cancer, kidney cancer, and thyroid cancer. In addition to those cancers, there's a few other cancers that we're looking at as well. Prostate cancer, pancreatic cancer, bladder cancer, and liver cancer. And any firefighter who has used AFFF more than a handful of times, who has developed one of those injuries, they should give us a call because we may be able to help them out.
All right. I mean, it's incredible. It's unbelievable. And certainly our heroes that are out there fighting the fires don't need anything else more causing them harm.
Exactly.
Larry, before we go, because we have a couple minutes left, let's just touch on real quick about one more time the vaccine, mass tort type situations, or the talk about that.
Yeah, it's particularly relevant right now with the COVID vaccine being pervasive, and a fight out there over whether we should use it or not. Are there risks? Simply put, everybody should recognize that there is a national vaccine court in Washington, D.C., in the federal claims court. There's a whole program that compensates people who have an adverse reaction to a vaccine, almost any vaccine. It's important to note that there are prerequisites. You have to be able to prove that you had a reaction to that vaccine. However, the COVID vaccine has not yet been included in the program. The law requires a couple of things. A vaccine has to be approved for general use, not emergency use, and it has to be approved for children before they will put it in the program, and Congress has to pass a bill, which is fairly routine, to add a new vaccine. So for now, if you're injured by a COVID vaccine, it's unlikely you're going to get any compensation.
What's the timetable on that, do you think?
We are lobbying. I'm the co-chair of the National Trial Lawyers Vaccine Litigation Group. We're working with a few Congress people and senators. We already have a bill drafted. It's already in Congress. We're working with the American Trial Lawyers Association to get the bill passed. We're hoping that within the year that bill is passed and people can get compensated for COVID vaccine injuries. I do want to finish with the few seconds that we have left. Bad reactions to vaccines are one in a million. And I mean one in a million. Anybody who listens to what I just said over the last 2 minutes and says, well, I'm not going to get a vaccine, you can have a bad reaction,
right,
they're missing the point. The vaccine program is designed to compensate that rare, rare, rare individual. At the same time, vaccines save millions of lives.
Sure.
The statistics demonstrate without any doubt, unequivocally, that you get your vaccines, all of them. There are no risks to any vaccine, including the COVID, that would justify not getting it in favor of I might get hurt.
So the chances of a vaccine preventing something are much greater than a bad reaction. So when you're talking about the vaccine court and all those things, those are for cases that are rare, but they do happen.
Exactly.
All right. Listen, gentlemen, I can't thank you enough for the information that you provided. I want to thank Larry Cohan and Joshua Cohan of Saltz Mongoluzzi and Bendesky, Mass Torts and Toxic Torts Division. Gentlemen, thanks so much, and continue the great job you do for the individuals out there that are in so much need. It's just been a pleasure.
Thank you, Joe.
We appreciate
being here.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Lawyer to Lawyer Network, Saltz Mongoluzzi and Bendesky Hour. I want to thank our guests, Larry Cohan and Joshua Cohan. On behalf of everybody on the panel, I'm Joe Dougherty. Have a great day.